Today on the Whole Child Podcast, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 guaranteed equal educational opportunities for all children. Yet more than 40 years later, disparities remain, especially in urban school districts. Federal policy, through No Child Left Behind, has focused primarily on raising standards, increasing testing and teacher quality, and accountability as the solution. But research has shown that children living in poverty experience a variety of conditions which impact their learning, and that the solutions to those challenges cannot be limited to the school alone. Put simply, if hunger and fear are the problems impacting learning, tutoring is not the answer. If we are intent on leaving no child left behind, what new strategies should we enact to improve educational achievement and life opportunities for urban school students? Up next on the Whole Child Podcast, changing the conversation about education. Hello and welcome to the Whole Child Podcast. I'm Molly McCloskey with the Whole Child Initiative for the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, ASCD. Our guests today take a different approach to improving urban schools, a distinctly whole child approach that moves beyond cognitive interventions as the sole strategy for improved achievement. Today we'll hear from New York University professor Pedro Noguera, who says it is impossible to bring about change in urban schools without tackling the socioeconomic needs of the children they serve. And next, Yvette Jackson of the National Urban Alliance says we need to change expectations about urban student achievement through a pedagogy of confidence. Finally, Principal Tatiana Epanchin shares how she fosters rigorous academic practice at the Monarch Academy, in part by ensuring her students are supported and nurtured. My first guest, Dr. Pedro Noguera, is an urban sociologist whose research focuses on the ways in which schools are influenced by social and economic conditions in the urban environment. In his book, City Schools and the American Dream, he argues that significant and sustainable improvements in urban schools will not occur until our country makes a genuine commitment to address the urban condition.
Pedro, thank you so much for joining us on the Whole Child Podcast this month. Your work really focuses on the impact of socioeconomic conditions in urban schools. Is there a recurring theme or an issue that you see in your research?
Yes, the big recurring theme is that inequality in society has a major impact on schools, and that the unmet needs of children that are related specifically to poverty, but also to the fact that many families are in crisis, also impact learning and impact what schools must do to respond to student needs. And we tend to have a higher concentration of such students in urban areas. The bolder, broader approach was really an attempt to call attention to the fact that if we want to see schools improve, if we really want to educate all children, which is the goal of No Child Behind, we have to recognize that there are many children out there who have greater needs, and that we need a broader and bolder approach to address those needs. So specifically, we call for things like universal preschool, because we know that early childhood education lays the foundation for learning that occurs throughout a child's life. We also call for health care for all children, because we know that children who are sick and who have need dental work or their eyes examined won't do as well in school, and we have large numbers of children in this country who don't have access to good health care. And then third, we call for extended learning time, to quality after-school programs, because simply many kids need far more time than they get for learning. They need to be in a safe environment where the need to learn and can be cultivated, and where they can get guidance and support and stay away from more troubled environments.
Now, you're a professor of education, but you really say that school improvement alone is not enough to raise achievement for urban school kids.
Right now, we're really asking a lot of schools. We're asking schools to solve problems that are not really educational in nature. And as a result, schools are overly burdened and being set up for failure. And I think when we look at the countries that consistently outperform the United States in education, countries like Canada or Holland or Japan and Singapore, those countries all do far more to support children than we do in this country, and they don't expect schools to solve all the problems. Those countries also have a much longer school year than our children do. So there's a lot we could learn by looking beyond the borders of this country.
Do you know of communities in this country that are getting it right?
There are several communities, I think, that are beginning to move in the right direction. And some of these are in urban areas. I think the Atlanta Public Schools have done a lot to improve their schools and to provide extra resources to schools and to provide scholarships, for example, to low-income kids so that college becomes more accessible to them. And I'm seeing lots of schools that have adopted a strategy of building services into the school, health services, after-school services, literacy programs for parents, so that they can do a better job at meeting the needs of the children they serve. And so there are examples of this working. The problem is that it's occurring in a very sporadic manner, and what we need is the federal government to exercise greater leadership to make this available wherever it's needed.
Arne Duncan was also one of the signatories to Broader Boulder. Does that give you hope, given his selection as Education Secretary?
It does, because Chicago actually had a greater number of full-service schools. These are schools that provide after-school and other social services than any district in the country. And that was really under his leadership and his vision. So I'm pretty sure that Arne Duncan gets it, that you have to address the whole child and not just focus narrowly on achievement. And I'm hoping that he'll bring that vision to the Department of Education.
Do you see hope? The entire presidential campaign was based on hope and change. Do you feel like this is a hopeful time for young people in America?
I think it is. I mean, I think that the new president came to us with a message of hope. It's true, though, that we're saddled with a tremendous economic catastrophe on our hands. But I also think that, you know, sometimes during the most bleak hours, like this bleak winter that we're in, you forget that things do turn around. And it may not happen right away, but I think that as they turn around, they're going to recognize that investing in education has to be part of the turnaround strategy. You can't revive the auto industry without reviving the workers who produce our cars. And that's true in other sectors as well. We've left too many Americans behind, and we've got to use education as a way of ensuring that a greater number of people who have been left out can fully participate in this country's prosperity and have access to the American dream.
I heard someone say the other day that children are really the ultimate investment in infrastructure.
Absolutely. I mean, the human capital is the ultimate infrastructure. And we see many jobs right now in this country that have been lost to other countries that have both cheaper labor and higher skills. And we've got to be able to compete for those jobs.
Pedro, we're grateful for your time today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and I wish you the best with this effort.
Thank you so much.
To learn more about Dr. Pedro Noguera's research on urban schools, please visit wholechildeducation.org/podcasts. Up next, we'll hear how the pedagogy of confidence may be the key to unlocking the immense potential in urban classrooms. The National Urban Alliance, led by CEO Yvette Jackson, believes all children can reach the highest levels of learning and thinking required in today's global society. All children. By working with teachers and administrators, the organization has helped urban school districts give students the tools they need to make a positive impact on American society at large. For many of these students, the most important of these tools is confidence.
Yvette, thank you so much for joining us on the Whole Child podcast.
You are welcome.
We're thrilled to have you here. Can you just give us sort of an opening statement about the National Urban Alliance, what you do, what your mission is?
Sure. The National Urban Alliance is, our mission is to change people's expectations about underachieving students to the point that we believe that all students are capable of high intellectual performance. So what we do, based on that belief, is to say, first of all, we're going to prove that intelligence is in fact modifiable, that when you provide students with high operational practices, those practices that engage them, that foster high intellectual development, they will perform at that level. So as an alliance, what we do is partner with school districts, not just to come in and do professional development, which focuses on pedagogy that looks at cognition and learning, but to really work with the district in partnership to put together the kind of supportive systems that are, in fact, going to allow this professional development to take hold so teachers feel supported, so teachers feel that, in fact, the whole system is going to raise their expectations.
When you go in, I know you work primarily with urban school districts. Are there commonalities among those districts that lead you to step in or that you would say make them most receptive to the kind of work that you do?
Well, it's interesting because we don't advertise that work at all. So every district we work in has reached out to us. Now what happens is when we go to the districts, because they've reached out to us, they already have this desire, and this is where one of the commonalities come in. There is a deep desire on the part of these districts we're working in to believe in the capacity of children for high intellectual performance, but at the same time they feel totally strangled by policies that foster a focus on weakness and create an fact, these silos that inhibit the school district from not only focusing on strengths, but in organizing itself so that every single opportunity within the district, whether it's how the district office staff work together, the focus of the teachers at the school level, the principals, in fact, what they're feeling is a differentiation that is marginalizing, not supportive. So what they come to us, first of all, saying, help us bring back a higher morale within the school district. Help us get people, teachers, principals to believe again in the high capacity, because what the districts are feeling is that for too long the focus has been on weaknesses. When agencies from the government or whatever come in to work with the district, they say, we're going to do data analysis, but that data is always about surfacing weaknesses as opposed to looking at capability and possibilities and options for kids and for teachers.
Well, and this is really interesting to me because you're talking about districts that are prepared to identify their students as underachieving as
That's
opposed
right.
to at risk or high poverty or some of the the more deficit-focused kind of labels. Is that how you got to your pedagogy of confidence?
Well, that's interesting because actually when we go to the districts, most of them are still using the marginalizing terminology. They will still say low-achieving students or disadvantaged students or minority students. I mean, there's the litany of terms that they've been using that they come by actually from the government, you know. So the issue is that as we work with them, our major influence or our major focus, which is how I got to the pedagogy of confidence, is to say, wait a second, those terms right off the bat are going to keep you from the focus on high intellectual performance, which therefore is going to keep achievement on a lower type of level. So what we are saying to districts that reach out to us is the first thing we have to focus on these high capabilities, and we do it by, first of all, changing the language. Second of all, we look at really what makes learning happen. And what we're doing is when the schools come to us, they say, well, how can we change our expectations? What do we have to put into place? And what we say and what is really the premise of a pedagogy of confidence is when you, in fact, really believe that your students have very high potential or deep potential for high achievement, then in fact you do something different. You have a different set of beliefs for those students. So in a pedagogy of confidence, what we say is, first of all, we're going to look at the kind of strategies and practices that are going to build up the confidence in the teachers to in fact reverse underachievement and start eliciting the potential at a much higher level. And once that starts happening, then not only does the confidence change, but the competence on the part of the teacher goes way, way far. And what winds up happening is then that is translated not only into the practices in the classroom, but also in the way teachers relate to students, that the teachers are coming together with the students and saying, together we're going to work at a much higher level because together we know we can achieve really a lot more for you personally, not only in school, but outside of school. And the other thing about a pedagogy of confidence is helping students to see why school is important, that it is not about a test, but in fact that we are here in school to engage your highest potential, those things that interest you, your strengths. We're using those together to push your performance ahead so that you can see the utility of school, not only while you're in here from 9 to 3, but how it connects to your world outside of school.
I think you just hit it on the head, because I know I frequently ask people when I'm doing work around the country to tell me about their favorite teacher. And the first thing that people always come up with was, he or she believed in me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That
makes all the
difference.
And you know, Molly, the thing is, when you believe, you really can achieve. However, people only believe when there really is a need. So if there is a need, if the government or whatever is saying there is a need to identify weaknesses, then you're going to believe that there are a lot of weaknesses. But if the system, which is our work, the National Urban Alliance, works with the district to say the need is really to surface, elicit, and promote high intellectual performance, then people will believe, in fact, that that is possible, and that is what our mission is.
Yvette, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
It has been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's always wonderful to talk to you and to work with ASCD.
To learn more about the pedagogy of confidence and the work of the National Urban Alliance, please visit wholechildeducation.org/podcasts. Up next, a principal from Oakland, California, talks about engaging and supporting students and teachers for school achievement and success. When Tatiana Epanchin became principal of Monarch Academy, she faced many challenges, including uninspired teachers, low expectations for students, and little family support. By enacting supportive programs for students and teachers, Tatiana was able to make a dramatic turnaround in her school. For the 2006-2007 academic year, Monarch was named the single most improved school in the state of California and received the U.S. Department of Education Title I Distinguished School Award. How'd she do it? Let's find out.
Tatiana, welcome to the Whole Child Podcast. We're thrilled that you're with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're a graduate of the New Leaders for New Schools program. Can you tell us a little about the program, why you decided to apply?
Yes. I was a teacher with Teach for America and then left the classroom and went into social work and then came back into the classroom in my 30s and founded a school with Aspire Public Schools, and little by little realized that if I were leading the school or had more of a leadership position, I would do things really differently. And not better necessarily, but differently. And I started thinking more and more about leadership and became a lead teacher and then started making more decisions school-wide for the school in that role, but still kind of fought this if I ran the zoo complex that I was having, and decided that I really wanted to become a principal and see if what I wanted to try would work, and decided on New Leaders because it was a national program instead of just one that is in a really isolated spot. So I had the privilege of working with people across the country who believe the same things about young people that I believe, but also who can help me think outside of the box when I'm stuck someplace in a way that people who are in the same situation that I am can't always do. So it's been a real pleasure working with that organization and building the relationships that I've had with them.
Yeah.
For those reasons.
Did you actually found Monarch Academy, or
I didn't
did you
found
come
it.
Into it?
I taught here in 2001 and 2002 and then founded Wilson Prep, which is the high school that the kids from Monarch Academy attend after being here. I founded that as a lead teacher. and stayed there for 3 years, and then came back to Monarch after 4 years of being at Wilson Prep. One of those years was my new leader's residency. And then in May of 2005, I came back to Monarch.
What was it like when you came back? What were the major issues at that point?
It was a school that I think from when you first walked in, one would say, wow, this is a pretty great school. It's bright, it's clean, you know, the kids are happy, there's not a ton of fighting, but it was not a place where you walked in and said, wow, kids are really learning here, and they're learning, and they're getting ready for college, and they're getting ready for life. You wouldn't be blown over by the quality of teaching that was going on across the board at the school, nor with the family participation, or with just that there was a common or shared vision. Teachers worked in their grade level teams really effectively, and they worked really really well together and had thought out units and things like that. But as far as sort of a collective vision and mission around, we are doing this work to undo some of the injustice that's happened to kids in living in high poverty urban areas, so that they can make choices that their parents haven't been allowed to make or that their caretakers haven't been able to make. That kind of work and vision wasn't happening.
Right. When we talk about the whole child, we say that we're committed to ensuring that all children are healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged. That any one of those is necessary but insufficient in and of itself.
Exactly. So I think pieces of those qualities were happening, but not the whole thing.
So what'd you do?
So I started being really open with my teachers about our data as a school, posting our data on the walls, writing to families about our data, talking to them about where I thought we could go. I certainly think that Monarch could become a school that's a 90-90-90 school, which would mean that we have at least 90% of our kids are of color, at least 90% of our kids are on free or reduced lunch, and at least 90% or more of our kids are achieving at high levels. So talked with my faculty a lot about that. Got into classrooms. I try to spend a majority of my time in classrooms giving teachers feedback, giving students feedback, having conversation and dialogue about progress with both teachers and kids and their families. I worked really hard to empower my leadership team. At every grade level, I have a lead teacher, and they are responsible for getting into a classroom every single week and doing an observation for somebody of their grade level, in addition to running team meetings for planning and data meetings once a week. I built in a data meeting every week where teachers are required to meet together during the school day while their kids are at meaningful integral classes, PE,
not
music.
Just specials.
Right, and we call them integrals because they're integral to our program.
Love it.
And because it's not something you can pull a student from because it is an academic class. So whether it's PE, whether it's music, whether it's library, you can't say, oh, well, your punishment today is to miss PE because you did A, B, or C. It's an integral class. It's an integral part of their growth and part of their learning. But it also allows my teachers to have a common prep time every single week where they have to look at a common piece of student work, whether that's a standardized test or a piece of writing or a math problem-solving example. It could be any number of things that they're looking at, but it has to be common, and they all the kids in that grade level have to have done it in order for us to spend time on it at a data meeting. Mm-hmm. I go as an active, as a participant observer. I do not go as a facilitator. My lead teachers facilitate that conversation. They create the norms for it. That, I think, has been really pivotal in our work, the fact that they have that 50-minute time every single week that's sacred.
Well, I'm curious if I can ask you, we hear an awful lot about folks who are scared of data. Don't want to look at the data, or data is being used in ways that is punitive. It sounds like you've used data to empower all the way from the kids themselves through instruction, through parents.
I've tried really hard to undo the feeling of nervousness around looking at data. I don't think we're there 100% by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly every time I have a new person come onto the faculty, we have to do some work around that this is how we are. It's not about, why did teacher A get these results and teacher B only got this. It's never that kind of a conversation. It's always like, wow, this is what I have and what my kids are doing, and I really need help in this one area because they're not doing as well as your kids are. So you're doing something that I'm not doing that I can learn from. And it's symbiotic. There's always, everybody has a strength that they can share out what they're doing or share their best practice on that. And everybody has something that their students aren't doing as well that they want help in. And so we've really tried to foster that over the last 4 years at Monarch.
So what's a day in the life look like for a student at Monarch?
It looks like starting the day by having a drumming circle outside, lining up, greeting your classmates, being greeted with a handshake or a hug by your teacher, by name, by me or another person who works in the office, because we're all outside as well. Having a drum circle, doing some call and response chanting, kind of just centering yourself and getting ready for the day. Going into your class, having a morning meeting, a la responsive classroom. And then just moving into academics, having really been able to kind of flush and shed whatever might have happened already that morning because you're in the safe spot and you're at school ready to learn and to work. My kids work in groups all day. They are cooperative learners. Students are asked constantly to speak in full sentences, regardless of how old they are. And it's a very done in a very supportive way.
Talk to me about your results.
We've had great results the 3 years that we've been measured that I've been here. We've increased our API by 150 points. We're up to a 776 right now on the API index in California. We've met our AYP goals set forth by No Child Left Behind. But in addition to that, my kids are becoming really good critical thinkers, and they're becoming excellent writers. And my fifth graders have to do an end-of-year, it's an all-year-long project, but an end-of-year culmination of presenting their learning to a panel of judges that they don't know. And they're articulate and able to talk. And I feel very confident that we're sending our fifth graders on to sixth grade with the skills that they need to be very productive in middle and high school so that they can be ready for college and be ready for life beyond college. And ultimately, that's the goal. That's what we're working for.
Tatiana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
To learn more about the Monarch Academy or the New Leaders for New Schools program, please visit wholechildeducation.org/podcasts. I want to thank all of our guests for their insights and perspectives on ways to transform urban schools. And thank you for joining us on the Whole Child podcast. Remember, you can download archived episodes and get links to additional information about our show topics at wholechildeducation.org. And if you have a comment or a question about this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Please send an email to wholechild@ascd.org and visit us at wholechildeducation.org to learn more about how you can support the Whole Child Initiative. In fact, visit the website now to sign the Whole Child petition, asking your State Board of Education to support policies and practices that ensure each student is healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged. When your state reaches the 1,000 signature threshold, we'll deliver that petition to your State Board of Education. Go on record now. Our next podcast will be coming to you live from the ASCD Annual Conference and Exhibit Show in Orlando, Florida, on March 14, 2009. I'm Molly McCloskey, and as always, let's keep working to ensure our students are healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged. Take care. The Whole Child Podcast is produced by ASCD, the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development. Visit us at www.ascd.org.